This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest is Baratunde Thurston, author of the new book, How to Be Black. It's part memoir and part satirical guidebook. Thurston is a stand-up comic, the director of digital for the satirical newspaper The Onion, and co-founder of the blog Jack and Jill Politics. The guidebook portion of the book includes such chapters as How to Be the Black Friend, How to Speak for All Black People, How to Be the Black Employee, How to Be the Angry Negro, and How to Be the Next Black President. The memoir part of his book is about the different cultures to which he's been exposed, like being enrolled in a Quaker private school and an Afrocentric program at the same time. And it's about how his life does and doesn't fit the popular concept of blackness, a concept he describes as hip-hop, crime in prison, fatherless homes, high blood pressure, school dropouts, drugs, athleticism, musical talent, The Wire, affirmative action, poverty, diabetes, the civil rights movement, and recently, the U.S. presidency. He spoke with Terry last week.
Baratunde Thurston, welcome to Fresh Air.
It is great to be here. Thanks, Terry.
So I'd like you to do a reading from your new book, How to Be Black. And it's a very autobiographical part of the book.
Yes, it is.
Would you read it for us?
Absolutely. My name is Baratunde Thurston, and I've been black for over 30 years. I was born in 1977 in Washington, D.C., in the wake of civil rights, black power, and Sanford and Son. My mother was a pro-black, pan-African, tofu-eating hippie who had me memorizing the countries of Africa and reading about apartheid before my 10th birthday. My Nigerian name was not handed down to me from any known lineage, but rather claimed and bestowed upon me by parents who demanded a connection, any connection at all, to Mother Africa. Yes, I grew up in the inner city at 1522 Newton Street, and I survived D.C.'s drug wars. Yes, my father was absent. He was shot to death in those same drug wars. But it's also true that I graduated from Sidwell Friends School, the educational home of Chelsea Clinton and the Obama girls, and Harvard University. I love classical music, computers, and camping. I've gone clubbing with the president of Georgia, the country, twice. My version of being black adheres as much to the stereotypes as it dramatically breaks from them. And that's probably true for most of you reading this. If not about blackness itself, then about something else related to your identity. Through my stories, I hope to expose you to another side of the black experience while offering practical comedic advice based on my own painful lessons learned.
Oh, great. Thanks for reading that.
Thank you.
And that's from Baratunde Thurston's new book, How to Be Black. So let's start with your name, which you say some really interesting things about in the book, the name being Baratunde Thurston.
Yes.
Very African first name, very...
Not African last name.
Not African second name, yes.
Yeah.
And you say, my name has served as a perfect window through which to examine my experience of blackness.
Yes.
So what reaction did you get to your name, typically from white people, from African Americans, and from Africans?
So very early on, teachers started shortening my name. They didn't want to deal with Baratunde. It was a little strange even for them, so they called me Barry. Actually, Barrington was the first name.
Was the
name
same with
a teacher.
Barack Obama, right?
Yeah,
he was Barry.
Yeah. So I'm just like the president. Yeah. I control the nuclear arsenal.
Exactly.
I occasionally disappoint my progressive base, but I'm generally a good guy. So yeah, I was Barrington, then I was Barry, and halfway through my middle school time at Sidwell Friends, it was seventh grade, and it just clicked in me. My name's Baratunde. That's a great name. People should call me that. And I had to actually convert the school to call me not Barry, but Baratunde. Because once people know what they call you, even if you don't approve of it, you know, nicknames, Chester is chest hair, right? Just stuff like that. It takes a long time to kind of undo that. So it took a couple of years to retrain people, but I finally fully asserted Baratunde as the name I should have. So people usually, they assume there's a nickname, and they'll just jump to it. Or they say, what do people call you for short? And I say, Baratunde. Just say it faster. You can save time and be a little bit more efficient if you're really worried about the time it takes to say the name.
So what assumptions were made about you because of your name?
Well, so it's really, I have different audiences that take it differently. First of all, I meet Nigerians, and many of them are initially really excited because they're like, oh, one of our brothers. But then they're like, wait, Baratunde? You mean Babatunde? And I'm like, no, I mean Baratunde. Well, where'd you get the name, and who did this? And so they have excitement, then frustration, then judgment often.
And the judgment is like, well, you're not really Nigerian.
Exactly. I'm not authentically Nigerian. I'm not really African, which is just fun given the idea of why I was given the name. Because I'm not really fully American either because of the history, this was my mother's attempt, and I didn't have any say in it. But I like the sound, and I like the meaning. So I have that community. Then you have kind of the more American-born black people who really generally don't have that much of a reaction, because I think American blacks are so used to very interesting names in our community, whether they're derived from Africa or just made up from cars, plus like a candy bar and the name of the street you grew up on. Like that's a pretty unique tradition. And then, you know, from white Americans, it's often the assumption of, well, you got to have a nickname. And or what does it mean? It's got to have some super deep meaning. And in my case, it actually does.
Because it was an African name, a name meant to connect you to Africa, because your parents, or at least your mother, was very interested in that connection. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that connection when you were growing up?
I did. And my mother wouldn't let me not feel that connection either. It was a part of my programming as a kid growing up. So grew up in D.C. in the Columbia Heights neighborhood before it became as shiny as it is today. And my mother, after sixth grade, enrolled me at Sidwell Friends School, which is a great private school. The Obama girls go there now. But she also, at the same time, enrolled me in what's known as a rites of passage program. And in the 60s, you know, along with black power, there was even a subset of Pan-Africanism where people were really trying to reclaim this connection and borrowing and learning from traditions. So you could think of it sort of as a Hebrew school or a bar mitzvah for blackness. And every, you know, weekday I'd be at Sidwell learning Sidwell-type things, and it's field hockey and lacrosse and the sons of presidents and daughters of World Health Organization people. And then every Saturday morning from maybe 7 a.m. to 1 p.m., we'd have physical training. We'd read books like the ISIS papers. We'd read Toussaint Louverture, and we would dance and do all sorts of cultural and intellectual activities to try to ground us in what they thought was a more appropriate Africanness in that era. It was also a time when crack was ravaging communities, and there was a special focus on how do we preserve young black boys and prevent them from ending up in the criminal justice system. So that was also an angle. So I had this balanced experience of like Sidwell by weekday, Ankobia, which is the name of the program, on the weekends. And that was kind of my strongest grounding. But then even at home, it didn't stop. My mom had this big map of Africa on her bedroom wall and had all the nations carved out. And she would actually quiz me.
So were you able to be the same person in both those settings? Or did you have to like adjust who you were? I mean, because a lot of us are, that's how we are. You know, you have different friends and you're slightly different with different friends. You're slightly different in different contexts.
Yeah, no, the code switching is a real thing. And I think there was a Baratunde from Newton Street who learned to walk those streets and navigate that world and be very comfortable with all the stuff that's happening in the street. And then there was the academic, library, studious, you know, high school newspaper Baratunde. And then there was the, like, Black Power Tunde that was also going down. And those worlds often collided. I remember I wrote a paper once for an English class that was extremely radical. It's the type of paper that I won't be president because I wrote this thing. Or it's one of those things they dig up, like Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah, you reprint some of it in the book. You have to read some of it.
Yeah.
You have to read some of it from the book. It's very conspiracy theory.
So the title of this piece is The U.S. Propaganda Machine, and that's what I submitted to my English teacher.
Find a really good
excerpt. Yeah, let me jump to a hyper-inflammatory section, which – all right, this is fun. Now, my brothers and sisters, I will tell you – and what you also have to understand is I wrote this as if it were a major speech that I was delivering to all black people. I imagine kind of a state of the black union with everybody around the world, and especially the U.S., tuned into to my words. Now, my brothers and sisters, I will tell you ways that the white man has led our people into this epidemic of violence. If you want to go way back, it all started when the Europeans invaded our rich, prosperous motherland and robbed her of her people. At the time of the slave trade, there were Africans who sold their own people for beads and jewelry. This was the beginning of our self-destruction. Another possibility is found by looking at the brutal times of slavery. During slavery, some of the brutalities were earth-shaking and unfathomable. And I remember being so proud of using the word unfathomable. And so I go and I blame the white man. I basically call for a reverse revolution against white people. And I turned in this paper very proudly, not at all conscious that this wasn't a normal thing to submit to a middle school English class at a place like Sidwell Friends. That was the Black Power Tunde speaking. And my English teacher came to me the next day, asked me to stay after class and said, hey, some pretty radical stuff you put in that paper. Would you have written that if I weren't black? And I was like, absolutely not. And I expect you to keep our secret. But that was a moment, a flashpoint for me of conflict. I was kind of using the ability to manipulate words that I was picking up at Sidwell, but with the ideas that I was sucking up Saturdays at this Oncobia Society, and it turned out into this kind of militant speech that I hypothetically delivered.
Were you taught that all of black people's problems were really a conspiracy by white people?
Well, so here was the beauty, and this is why the mix is so important. Even I talk about my mother's evolution in her life. I talk about my mix in this neighborhood. I was taught extremes and able to balance them because I was taught multiple extremes. So at a place like Sidwell, and Sidwell's a great school. It really is. But it was also a tough place to be one of the few minority kids, one of the few poorer kids, and there's a big social adjustment. And one of the arguments there was we need more black faculty. We need more black subjects in the curriculum. That always happens at any sort of school, especially kind of elite secondary and colleges. Meanwhile, in the Oncobia environment, it was Africa did this, Africa invented that, Imhotep this, blah, 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 and the white man caused these problems. Those either cancel each other out or they drive the bearer of both ideas insane.
Right.
I didn't go insane. And fortunately, and I think most people in that situation probably wouldn't. So it sort of encouraged me to both see the good in both sides and also challenge both perspectives.
At Harvard, you say you learned how important and powerful the role of black friend to white people could be. Explain that.
A lot of white people like black people. Right. They buy hip hop. They like watching black athletic and sports figures and movie figures. And this black culture is super popular from jazz through hip hop and everything else that's come in between and beyond. And so having a black friend, which I think is actually in the book Stuff White People Like that Christian Lander wrote, is a mark of kind of progressive success as a white person. And the black friend that they have is usually seen as their asset. It's like, oh, I'm cooler by proxy. I can get my questions answered. I'm hip. What I try to describe in the book a little more is like what black people get out of having emissaries in the white community as the black friend.
What do they get?
Well, you have a covert operative behind enemy lines. You've got a trusted source who can shuttle information back and forth. It's like the Cold War. It's basically a back channel that prevents race wars from blowing up. So if your white friend has a question about something, they can ask you, their trusted black friend, and you can feed them real or false information, depending on your purposes, but they don't necessarily have to just make an assumption or make a leap that ends up in some even more awkward, more public moment. So it's actually very important to have this cross-cultural exchange of actual friendship going on, and the black friend is a really, really big part of preventing that conflagration.
I want to quote something else from the book. You write that upon graduation from Harvard, you say, I was conscious of the fact that I could be me and thus be black, but not have to be black in order to be me.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Harvard was a liberating experience, which I don't know many black people who would say that, but it was because of Sidwell. I spent 6 years at Sidwell Friends going through, there is a typical life cycle kind of minority in private school. First, they challenge your right to be there and say it's all affirmative action. You feel awkward. Your friends back home judge you as selling out. You have the black student union. You probably protest something. Someone writes the N-word on the wall or in the bathroom or in your locker. Like, these things are going to happen. And by the time I got to Harvard, I'd been through all of that. And then I could just, Harvard's a great place. It can be a really great place if you can enjoy it and take advantage of it. And I was able to do that there. So I was involved in the Black Students Association at Harvard. But at Sidwell, I felt this like absolute obligation to like fight and lead and protest and write reports. And at Harvard, I still was actively involved in that black community, but it wasn't the core source for like my full identity. And I felt as comfortable hanging out with the kids at the newspaper, hanging out with the kids with the Computer Society and the theater kids. And Black became more of a part of my identity and less of kind of an ongoing protest movement, which it can often be because you often feel besieged. And I was able to let go of that feeling of being besieged and just sort of be instead. And so there were protests and there were controversies, but I think I was able to not let them define me or limit my definition of myself, certainly not affect my feeling of a right to be there. And so many folks, that's a harsher transition when they haven't had the boot camp of some kind of private school to prepare them.
My guest is Baratunde Thurston. He's the author of the new book, How to Be Black. It's a memoir. It's satirical also. He's the director of digital for the satirical newspaper The Onion. He also does stand-up comedy. Your book, How to Be Black, is part satirical self-help book.
Yeah.
And one of the chapters is about how to take advantage of the booming Black spokesperson market and provide a valuable service to the nation's clueless media outlets. What's the kind of spokespersons you're thinking of there?
So I'm thinking of, first of all, a spokesperson who fills a void. And I think actually the world is getting better at this. But for most of media history, there would be a pile of things happening called Black things. And they would be associated with, okay, there's a drug problem, there's a crime thing, there's some sports thing, there's some R&B soul, hip-hop thing. We got to get, there's a riot somewhere. Quick, grab a Black guy, throw him on air. And that was often some reverend-type figure, Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson. And they would be looked to kind of fill that void and speak for all Black people. And ever since King and X, people have in the mainstream have been like, well, who speaks for Black people now? Farrakhan maybe had the last go around with the Million Man March, and people still try to ascribe all Black thought occasionally to him. So this Black spokesperson idea in the book is to kind of mock that desperation that, okay, we got to get somebody to explain all of Blackness. I don't care who it is. I don't care what the qualifications are. Is it a dude in a suit who ran some kind of organization with the word national and organization in it? Put him on, mic him up, get some foundation makeup on him, and let's just have him talk. And it's almost always a him.
My impression now is that, in part ever since Obama was elected, that there's a much wider, like on the news channels, for instance, a much wider representation of African-American like pundits and experts and think tank people and bloggers and so on.
I actually agree with you, and I think that's part of the transition we're in. Because we're entering a world where we need less to ask permission from sort of centralized authority, whether it's media authorities to get a certain image out, whether it's political authorities to promote a certain policy, whether it's religious authorities to express a certain type of spirituality. The range of Black thought and Jack and Jill politics is a part of this booming tradition of Black people just representing themselves. And when that happens and when we're all given not just the right to demand change or the right to work from the inside to adjust the system or protest, but to actually build native systems, to build your own perspective and voice using these tools, a lot of them technologically based, you can't help but diversify the range of that conversation. I've been, you know, this chapter also kind of mocks myself a bit because I've been that Black pundit. And they go, oh, now we have Baratunde Thurston from Jack and Jill Politics to talk about something related to Blackness. And I remember Rod Blagojevich, former governor of Illinois, said something dumb, which is should not be newsmaking at a certain point because that's what he does. And he said, I'm Blacker than Obama. And some cable news outlet, they said, we'd love you to come on and talk about Rod Blagojevich's comment that he's Blacker than Obama. I was like, what? There's nothing to say. Let the dumbness stand on its own sometimes and just sit out there.
So you declined?
I declined because the idea of Rod Blagojevich, who was an attention-seeking dude, saying something absurd, and a white guy saying he's Blacker than a Black guy, which has been done before, it's kind of hacked too, just wasn't that interesting.
So it strikes me that as an African-American memoirist and...
Ooh, I'm a memoirist.
and blogger and you know, pundit, that you're in a kind of interesting spot in the sense, on the one hand, you're satirizing the whole idea of like spokespeople speaking about the Black community and, you know, spokespeople being in a way confined to talking about the African-American issues of the day. But at the same time, you know, you start Jack and Jill Politics to specifically address what a certain socioeconomic bracket of African Americans are thinking.
Yeah.
And your book is called How to Be Black, and it's all about your experiences as a black boy, as a black man.
Yeah.
And it's satirical,
mm-hmm.
but it's there's a lot of real genuine emotion in it,
yeah.
in it too. I'm not sure exactly what the question is, but I think it has to do with being at that point in time where you can kind of stand back and satirize the whole idea of like the black spokespeople, but at the same time feel like, but that's still needed.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That you still have to be there representing African-American points of view in what is still a kind of white dominant culture politically and socially.
Part of the mission of this book, besides being uproariously funny and occasionally tear-jerkingly emotional, is as I said in the intro, to recomplicate blackness and to just put out some other examples. Because we're at a time where the gap between who we really are and who the world expects us to be can be closed, because we can articulate who we are much more loudly than any of our ancestors. We can paint ourselves better. And so this book, what I hope, it's definitely steeped in blackness because a part of me has been, but there's also so many quote-unquote non-black things. All the gardening stuff and the computer science-y stuff. You don't see those held up as shining examples of blackness. But I'm black and I do those things. And Elon James White, who I interviewed, he had a great line to kind of sum this up. He said, you know, you don't have to do any particular thing to be black, right? You do what you do and you open up the doors to blackness. And that's kind of a fun way to think, not just about blackness, but about the self and about identity in general. And so this book could be How to Be Jewish. It could be How to Be a Woman. It could be How to Be Gay. And I probably should buy all those domain names right now so I can cash in, cha-ching, and make money off my tweets. But I think that everyone has had some kind of experience of like, well, I'm not who people think I am or think I should be because their information about me is so off. We can kind of change that information.
Baratunde Thurston, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure to talk with
you. This has been a life goal. I'm checking this off the bucket list. Thank you so very much, Terry.
Baratunde Thurston is the author of the new book, How to Be Black. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Singer-songwriter Leonard Cohen, who is now in his late 70s, released a new album this week called Old Ideas. Rock critic Ken Tucker says this collection of Cohen songs works as both pop music and as prayers.
Tell me again when I've been to the river and I've taken the edge off my thirst. Tell me again we're alone and I'm listening, but listening so hard that it hurts. Tell me again when I'm clean and I'm sober. Tell me again when I've seen through the horror. Tell me again, tell me over and over. Tell me that you want me then. Amen. 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 Amen.
At this point in his life, Leonard Cohen sings in a voice so deep and bottomless, he may as well be singing from underneath the earth. But that doesn't mean it's faint or murky or dead. Indeed, Cohen is somehow capable of making a cracked baritone that enunciates meticulous lyrics sound searching, restless, and jaunty. This has long been Cohen's saving grace. His dry humor juices up his more portentous pronouncements.
You know, it really is a pity the way you treat me now. I know you can't forgive me, but forgive me anyhow. The ending got so ugly, I even heard you say you never ever loved me, but could you love me anyway? I dreamed about you, baby, you were. I know you have to hate me, but could you hate me less? I've used up all my chances and you'll never take me back. But there ain't no harm in asking, could you cut me one more slack? I'm naked and I'm filthy.
I said something about saving grace before, and on Old Ideas, the spiritual meaning of that phrase resonates frequently. Cohen spends some time here asking forgiveness of old lovers and of God, careful to make it unclear which is more important to him. Cohen asks a woman, "I know you have to hate me, but could you hate me less?" as female voices rise up as if in support of the old man's position. Perhaps he hired them, one is left to imagine, to provide support for his wooing of the woman he's imploring. "Have mercy on me, baby," he concludes. The instrumentation and genres on Old Ideas vary. Some songs are smooth pop ballads that slide along keyboard riffs. Others are folkier, with acoustic guitar prominent. A good example of Cohen's kind of folk music is Crazy to Love You.
Had to go crazy to love you. Had to go down to the pit. Had to do time in the tower, begging my crazy to quit. Had to go crazy to love you. You who were never the one, whom I chased through the souvenir heartache, her braids and her blouse all undone. Sometimes I'd head for the highway. I'm old and the mirrors don't lie, but crazy has places to hide in that are deeper than any goodbye.
The killer couplet there is, crazy has places to hide in that are deeper than any goodbye. That Cohen is as much in touch with his craziness and his carnal urges as he is with his always perilous spiritual state gives Old Ideas its pleasing, sometimes poignant tension.
Behold the gates of mercy in arbitrary space, and none of us deserving the cruelty or the grace. Oh, solitude of longing, where love has been confined, come healing of the body, come healing of the mind. Oh, see the darkness yielding that tore the light apart, come healing of the reason, come healing of the heart.
That song talks about a healing of the spirit and the body, perhaps in preparation for a darkness that becomes clear in another song about death titled Darkness. But there's not a trace of morbidity or self-pity or regret on 1 second of this entire album. Leonard Cohen is making music vital to his spirit, confident that a song transmits its essential nature directly to any listener receptive to his message. In this sense, Old Ideas is an inspirational album from a very lively old coot.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Leonard Cohen's new album called Old Ideas. If you're African-American and name your band the Negro Problem, you're unlikely to shy away from tackling issues about race. Our next guest, that band's founder and lead singer, Stu, doesn't. He and his songwriting collaborator and bass player, Heidi Rodewald, who is white, wrote a musical called Passing Strange, based on Stu's life. It won a Tony on Broadway and several Drama Desk Awards, including Outstanding Musical. Passing Strange is set in the 70s. The main character, called Youth, is African-American, but his taste in music, which includes rock and psychedelic music, doesn't conform to what the African-American teenagers around him enjoy. Having an identity crisis because he's not considered black enough, he leaves L.A. for Amsterdam and Germany, where he discovers avant-garde music and theater, Stu and his collaborator Heidi, when they wrote Passing Strange, were a couple. But they broke up during the run of that show. They're still collaborating, however, and their new album, Making It, is under the band name Stu and the Negro Problem. Terry spoke with Stu last week. They began with the song Pretend, which is about the breakup.
Plays are real if you pretend you are too until the end. Trapped in a homegrown masquerade. Costumes wrong but so well made. Curtain fell but who got played? Plays are cool, don't get me wrong. But as a rule, they're way too long. So damn smart and they mystify. Songs are dumb, but they don't lie. Songs are dumb, but they don't lie.
Stu, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's really a pleasure to have you. The new album is in part about your relationship with your co-songwriter and bass player, Heidi Rodewald, and you worked on Passing Strange together. And I know that you broke up during or just before the start of the performances. I'm a little unclear on that, but the album, you know, deals with the breakup of that relationship. So just give us just to orient us a little bit, when did you actually break up within that process?
Heidi and I, we broke up in the green room of the Berklee Repertory Theater during the 2006 winter run of Passing Strange, or maybe it was the fall run of Passing Strange, but 2006. So we basically broke up in 2006 and then spent 2 years being a broken up couple in a play, which is kind of like getting a divorce and staying in the same house for 2 years after.
That sounds horrible.
there are more pleasurable things to do, especially when you're in a play that's about love and loss and art. And I mean, you couldn't break up in a worse play, you know, for two people who had been creating together all that time. And then suddenly to have to go, okay, this is over. And then the next day you're you're in a play looking at that person across the stage singing songs about love and loss and art. It couldn't have been better. You know?
Plus the breakups in the green room of the theaters. So you have to put your public face on when you leave the green room, right? I mean,
I don't know if we were good at the public face thing. I think, you know, when you're working in theater, it's like being on a ship. So everything that happens in a dressing room, especially if it's screamed at a loud volume, or let's say if a cup happens to fly through the room just by accident, just because it's haunted, you know, because the theater is haunted. If a cup flies through the room and breaks against the wall, everyone hears that, you know. So when you're in a play, everybody knows what's going on the ship, you know.
But you've obviously decided to keep collaborating as a couple because you wrote these songs, and in part these songs are about the breakup. So what has kept you together as collaborators in spite of the end of your romantic relationship?
Well, I think we realized because at first we thought, well, there's no way this is going to be able to continue. But you start to realize as artists and as collaborators that there's a different kind of love. There's a romantic love, but then there's art love. There's like a collaborator love that exists, you know, that is really just as strong as romance, you know, arguably stronger, because to me, my artistic relationship with Heidi, to me, is never ending, because there's nobody like her who was, you know, born in the same part of the United States, listened to the exact same radio as me, watched the same TV shows as me, saw the same punk bands as me, you know. You can't break up with that, you know.
So let's talk a little bit about Passing Strange, which is the musical that you were performing when you broke up. And this is it's autobiographical fiction is the way you describe it. And it's a story about leaving home to go far away, to basically try on different personalities and in the process figure out who you really are. A complicating factor for the character in Passing Strange, which I assume was maybe a complicating factor for you, is that, you know, being African-American, who he wanted to be, what his tastes in music are, didn't quite fit with what was expected of him as a black man.
Certainly, yeah, right. Not in his neighborhood where he grew up. Absolutely not.
Your predicament?
Most definitely. My predicament and my circle of friends, the guys I grew up with, you know, black guys who liked crazy rock music, particularly the kind where men wore feather boas and had really high heels. You know, you did not want to be on the bus that I took home holding a David Bowie record from the early 70s. So, you know, it really was sort of like, you know, there's one thing where you're just listening to weird music that freaks your mom out. Everybody does that. But, you know, I think we were doing something that was not just freaking our mom out, but it was freaking our friends out as well. It wasn't that we didn't like the music that was on, quote unquote, soul radio, but we just liked all music. And we seemed weird because we liked all music. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So how were you introduced to music like David Bowie, but also punk rock?
Through black rock musicians, oddly enough. I mean, the older guys in my neighborhood liked everything. The first time I ever heard early Pink Floyd or Led Zeppelin was from the black guys in my neighborhood who were like 5 and 6 years older than me. They were very much from this sort of 60s mentality. The first time I ever had headphones on listening to Abbey Road was, I was about, God knows how old, 8 years old or something, and I was at a cousin's house. So it wasn't like I went to this white world and discovered all this fancy music. You know, the L.A. that I grew up in was a place where, you know, musicians are always eclectic. Musicians are always curious and hungry for new things. But suddenly when I had to navigate on my own, like holding those records on my own and sort of having to defend my taste, and that having to defend my taste suddenly meant having to defend my position within my culture, which was something that I just didn't see the connection with. I didn't understand why what I was interested in, what kind of art I was interested in, had to reflect on my membership of my, you know what I mean, of my community. I didn't see the connection between those two things.
So in the show, in Passing Strange, the mother, and kind of your mother, because the main character is like your surrogate. So the mother is described as like a churchgoer who insists that you go to church.
Right. Well, let's be clear. She wasn't my mother. She was the mother of the boy
character
in the play.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So
what
was church like for you, and were you expected to go?
My mom never went. She wanted me to go all the time. And I didn't want to go, but when I got there, I loved the music and I loved the social aspect of it, but particularly the music. And once I made the connection between the blues scales that I was learning on guitar and the musical language of the preacher, that was like the big epiphany for me. That was probably when I decided that I'm going to do this for a living, because I realized that here was this connection really between like the Beatles and God, you could say. You know, I mean, this was like the connection that no one really told me existed, but this was like, oh, okay, so my minister sounds like Howlin' Wolf. And nobody told me. I didn't even, until I learned those blues scales, I made that connection. Like, oh my God, my minister is singing the same notes that Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf sing. And I'm like, why didn't anybody tell me this is what was happening? You know? And that was it for me. I was on. It was on from that moment on.
So in the show Passing Strange, the character Youth leaves home in part because the things Youth really loves, the music he really loves, are not considered authentically black. And he wants, you know, he wants to find a place where he can be himself, whatever that is, because he's still Youth and isn't completely sure what himself is. So,
right.
So you know, he goes to Amsterdam, and there he's seen as like, the ghetto warrior. Because it's like
mostly in Berlin, but yeah.
So when you were in Europe, what were some of the things projected onto you simply because you were African American?
That I must know somebody in Grandmaster Flash. They immediately think everything that they've seen on TV. They think that you are from a really, really, really hardcore ghetto. And this is something that pre-internet, you know, they really had no idea. You know, they really had no idea. So they would assume immediately that you were from the hood. And the hood in their mind was a compilation of every single cop show, action movie, urban action movie that they'd ever seen in their lives, you know. So all these things were expected of us, you know, like we would be great dancers. You would go to a discotheque and people would assume, like, when you, like, we would hit the dance floor and people would immediately form like a circle around us. And I'm like, I'm not going to do anything worth watching. Stop looking at me. You know what I mean? But I mean, it sounds like prehistoric times. Now people, you know, kids in Munich know everything that kids in Brooklyn are doing, and kids in Brooklyn know everything that people in Lagos are doing. Do you know what I mean? Uh-huh. So everybody knows what everybody's doing now. But back then, you didn't really know. You know, and you could make up whatever you wanted because nobody knew.
So I want to play a song from Passing Strange.
Okay.
And this is a song called The Black One. And it kind of fits into exactly what we're talking about. In the show, right before the song is sung, Youth, which is the character that's loosely based on you, has been reading this like poem about how he's bleeding sunshine and emptying his veins. and one of his women friends says to him, "Only the slums of America could produce such pain, exquisite, like an orgasm in reverse." And then he starts singing the song, The Black One. Why don't you set up the song for us?
We really wanted to have like a Broadway kind of parody tune in our play. We made a big stink when we were at Sundance working on the play. We made a big stink, you know, about how, you know, we want to make this play the real music, the real rock music that we want to make, and we don't want to compromise, da 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 da. And of course, everybody was fine with that. And then we were like, but we have to have one song that's like one of those Broadway type tunes. So we literally wrote it in the time it took to just write a song, like literally, like in real time, because all the chord changes are completely cliche and as is the melody. So we just wrote it like immediately and started rehearsing it, and it just became this thing that we had to do. You know, it's our little tribute to Broadway.
I really like it though.
I like it too. We do a really mellow version of it now, which actually kind of points out that it's not as bad a song as we intended it to be.
No, and the lyrics are really funny.
No, the lyrics are funny. Well, that's what I do, though. I mean, that's you know, funny lyrics, that's me.
And it has the expression postmodern lawn jockey sculpture.
That's true. That's like the third song that's used that phrase, actually, though. There's a...
You're stealing from
kidding.
Yourself?
I'm just kidding. No, oh. I'm just kidding.
All right. So this is The Black One, sung by Stu from the cast recording of Passing Strange.
The club that speakeasy air, the black one, the black one, who dances like a god and has wunderbar hair, der Schwarze. Now he's the life of every soiree, he'll give the bums rush to your ennui. Turn up these lights, cause I barely can see the black one. Is he the postmodern lawn jockey sculpture?
The black fun.
The black one. Or just a soul on a roll exploding your culture? That black one.
An artist creates surfaces.
And then comes the fee. He's doing the same thing.
Except I call the surface me.
He's dancing in a cage.
But I'm the one with the key.
And he's the black one.
That's The Black One from the cast recording of Passing Strange, a song written by Stu and his musical collaborator Heidi Rodewald. And Stu and Heidi have a new album under the name Stu and the Negro Problem. That's the name of his band. And the album's called Making It. So you record under two names. You record under the name Stu and under the name The Negro Problem. And The Negro Problem, you know, why don't you explain why you called your group that?
We were sitting around doing what all bands do way back in 1990, and we did what every band does. We made a list of band names and brought the names to rehearsal, and everybody read the names off. You know, I brought in the name The Negro Problem, and we couldn't stop laughing at the name. You know, we tried to move on with the rest of the session, which was the point of which was to come up with a band name, and we just couldn't stop laughing at the idea of this all-white band fronted by this black guy called The Negro Problem. We just kept laughing. And I remember very clearly one of the band members going, "Are you sure we want to do this?" And I'm like, "Well, yeah, what the hell? We're just a band. It's not like we're a, you know, we're not a political party or a country. It's not like naming a new antidepressant or something, a drug or something. We're just a stupid band, you know, and if it doesn't work, we'll change the name back, you know, to something else." And it worked. People started showing up going, "You know what? I'm here in LA for the weekend. I looked through the newspaper. I saw your band name. I have no idea what you guys sound like, but I'm here because it's an outrageous band name." And for us, it was taken, it was, you know, a lot of my influence, a lot of our influence in The Negro Problem is like late 60s psychedelia. So, you know, names like the Strawberry Alarm Clock, you know, or like, you know, even names like the Velvet Underground, those names existed because back in the day when there weren't like official, like, you know, cards and record stores where you knew this genre and that genre, if you were called the Strawberry Alarm Clock, that was telling that 17-year-old in the record store that you're not Perry Como. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
So band names used to have like a very strong, they used to be messages. They used to be like commercials for the band. And I thought a name like The Negro Problem would do two things. It would alienate a whole bunch of people, but it would also, we'd also find our tribe, so to speak, the people who were as irreverent as us and as, you know, so just had the same sense of humor as us. The people who took it too seriously, whatever. I mean, we don't need them anyway.
Well, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you. Thank you for the music.
It's been fun. Thanks so much.
Stu of the band Stu and the Negro Problem speaking with Terry Gross. Their new album is called Making It. You can hear three tracks from the album at our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inclusive.